Thank you very much. My mother wrote the back flap. They actually had to edit it down from the original 100 pages. So I'd like to introduce you to you a new vocabulary word. It's a new word which a student of mine invented, and it's a verb, I think it's an important new word in the Jewish vocabulary. The word is bageling. To bagel, to be bageled, to bagel. Bageling is the following phenomenon. You are somewhere, and you look Jewish. You may be wearing a Magen David or a yarmulke or whatever. And someone else who is Jewish, but doesn't necessarily look obviously Jewish, will almost inevitably feel a deep need to identify themselves to you as also Jewish. They will do this by random Yiddish words or Hebrew words in totally out of context in the middle of nowhere. You could be walking somewhere, you could be in the mall, right, and someone will walk by and say, Yortzeit, or Mazel Tov, or herring, or something like that, or whitefish salad, whatever, right? That will be their way of identifying themselves to you as Jewish. This is called bageling. When that happens, you have been bageled. I was in Australia with my daughter, 12-year-old daughter, just 3 weeks ago. We got back from Australia for my father's 85th birthday, and we were in the departure lounge in Melbourne Airport, and there was a couple who were standing a few people behind us in line, and they kept looking at me and nudging each other. And I said to my daughter, Miriam, we're about to be bageled. Her reaction was, Abba, you know, like Dad, you know, that type of thing, which is a standard reaction. And we got on the plane and we sat down. This couple walks by us and the guy says to me, Boker Tov, which means good morning in Hebrew, right? And I said, Boker Tov to you. And I said, uh-huh, you know, we've been bageled, right? So that's called being bageled. It happens all the time. I was in Harrods in London once. Harrods, very posh department store in London. I was checking out the price of shopping bags, which is pretty much all I can get there. And standing next to me was an extremely upper crust English couple. Very, so upper crust, this guy was wearing a silk cravat. You know, smoking jacket and a cravat, have you ever seen that? I mean, not outside of a movie, right? It's very rare to see. No one's wearing a cravat. Okay, so anyway, just thought I should check this. Anyway, they're standing there, he and his wife standing there. I mean, wouldn't have a clue that they're Jewish. As far as I knew, this was, you know, Philip, Duke of Edinburgh, right? And they're standing there looking at some object d'art, surreptitiously glancing at me every now and again. And the guy says to his wife, dear, she says, yes, he says, oy vey, this is quite expensive. I said, I've been bageled. Why do I mention the phenomenon of bageling? Because the phenomenon of bageling, a universal phenomenon in the Jewish world, is due to the fact that Jews feel part of one entity, even if they look different, even if we speak different, even if we have different languages, and we eat different foods, and we belong to different temples or synagogues or whatever it is, we feel a certain commonality. We feel part of this one unit called the Jewish people. And I think it is a wonderful and beautiful thing. When a person bagels, they do not ask if you're Orthodox or Reform or Conservadox or whatever it is, right? They just bagel you, right? And it's a very nice thing. There's a certain unity there. One of the great sages of Sa'adja Gaon, who lived a long time ago, in the 9th, 10th century, he said, Ein umatenu uma ela b'torata. Our nation is a nation by virtue of the Torah. What makes our nation a nation? What unites the Jewish people? When you think about it, it's not food. I mean, we all do love food, yes. We are, in the words of David Cooper of Oxford University, a gastrocentric people. Right? This is true. But we have radically different tastes in food. Radically different tastes. Our languages are not the same. I mean, there are Jews out there many Jews out there whose native language is Arabic. There are many Jews whose native language is Farsi, whose native language is German, whose native language is English, etc., etc. Right? We don't have a common native language. We are united by the fact that we all have in common Judaism, Torah. And that has been around for thousands of years. What I'd like to do is introduce to you what I think are six very, very basic concepts that are a gateway, an introduction to what Judaism is. If you wanted to summarize it, I tried to summarize it in one book. You should still keep your Bibles, even if you get my book, right? Nevertheless, right, I have tried to somehow summarize Judaism, and this is a summary of the summary. Recently I saw that Stephen Hawking, great physicist, who wrote the book Brief History of Time, which is about, was about 200 pages, I think it was, and he just came out with an even briefer history of time, which is about 100 pages. I mean, if he can do 15.3 billion years in 100 pages, I think Judaism in 500 or so pages is not bad, right? Because Judaism is a lot more than just the universe. It's actually not only the revealed universe, it's also the hidden universe. So let me start with the first component of what I think is essential and central to Judaism, which is the idea of the purpose of humanity. We believe that we believe there's a purpose that's not universally held. Stephen Jay Gould and others, we discussed this at lunchtime today in Center City at Temple University, that there are many naturalists, I would call them, exclude God from the picture and say there is no purpose. You cannot attribute purpose when there's no purpose giver. You cannot attribute purpose when there's no intelligence behind something. If it's purely arbitrary, random, one of many probable or possible universes out of an infinite amount of multiverses, in the words of Johnson, then there is no purpose. Just, that's the way it is. Kach haderech sha'ugiyah mitpareret, the ancient Hebrew saying goes. That is the way the cookie crumbles. Right? So, the idea, therefore, of purpose, the purpose of humanity, is that we actually do have a purpose here. We do not look at ourselves as stuck within an immutable world in which everything is predetermined. We do not agree with that. We do not look at the world as predetermined by natural law. We don't look at it as predetermined by fate. We look at the world as a world in which the human being has a tremendous, tremendous power. Tremendous power. The power to create, power to destroy, the power of refinement of the world. I think this is, the Talmud says, the mitzvot were given in order to refine humanity, to improve and to perfect the world. That's the basic concept here. I've told this story many times. Ternus Rufus, a Roman, used to debate the rabbis very often. He came once to Rabbi Akiva, one of the great sages of the Talmud, and he said to Rabbi Akiva, Ternus Rufus the Roman, he says, Rabbi Akiva, what's the... I don't know if he had an Italian accent. Why, you ever wondered that? Like the Julius Caesar, was he like the, you know, the godfather type of sitting there? Right? So anyway, this guy, Luca Bracci, Ternus Rufus comes to Rabbi Akiva and he says, what's better, the deeds of God or the deeds of man? The deeds of God or the deeds of man? What was he asking? He was asking the following. He felt this was a defeater of a question. This was a question that could not be answered. Because you see, if Rabbi Akiva would say the deeds of God are superior, he would then ask, then how can you change anything in the world? How dare you? How dare you do circumcision? How dare you cut your hair? How dare you mow the grass? How dare you turn wheat into bread? How could you do anything? If God created the perfect world, who are you to change it? And he then, if Rabbi Akiva would answer, no, the deeds of man are better than those of God, he'd then say, you are a heretic. How could you say, Ternus Rufus would then say, you, Rabbi Akiva, are a heretic. How could you dare say that the deeds of man are better than those of God? So, this is the question Ternus Rufus asks Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva does not answer. He goes to the fridge, and he comes back from the fridge with a stalk of wheat in one hand and a three-layer sacha torte chocolate mousse cake combination in the other. You know, sacha torte with slight hint of raspberry, very moist chocolate cake with the three layers of chocolate mousse, white chocolate, dark chocolate, milk chocolate mousse, little shavings of chocolate on the top. I'm sorry, okay. Little maraschino cherries. Okay. Anyway, so he comes out with the wheat and the cake. And he says, Rabbi Akiva says to Ternus Rufus, okay, mate, you tell me which is better. Stalk of wheat, deeds of God, or deeds of man? Chocolate mousse cake. Now, what was Rabbi Akiva trying to teach us here? How was he answering Turnus Rufus? I think the idea of his answer was a very simple idea, which is that just as the wheat is designed not to be eaten as it is, but to be turned into something superior, be it bagel, be it chocolate mousse cake, etc., so also the human is not created perfect, the world is not created perfect. This is not the perfect world. It's the world that's created to be perfected. If anyone has read Voltaire's play Candide, you will know, what is it that Dr. Pangloss, the religious guy, is saying all the time? What does Dr. Pangloss say again and again? This is the best of all possible worlds, correct? We, if it had it not been Dr. Pangloss, but Rabbi Pangloss, he would have been saying, this is not the best of all possible worlds, it's the world which is designed to be made into the best of all possible worlds, but it's not there yet. That's what it would have been. Because we say that is the idea of the world, and there are three major areas in which we have to refine and perfect the world, and everything, all of them, are to do with relationships. There's a story told in the Talmud, the Gemara in Shabbos, of a non-Jew who came to the sage Shammai. And he said to Shammai, I'd like to convert to Judaism. And Shammai says, okay, that's very nice. And he says, on condition that you teach me the whole Torah while standing on one foot. So Shammai said, get out of here. He threw him out. He says, you don't make conditions. You want to join, you join. You don't make conditions. It's like coming to America. You know, if I decide to become a citizen of America, right, at the swearing in, right, or whatever they do in the ceremony, I'll say, just one thing. I'd like to do this conditional upon, I'm accepting everything really in American law. I'm happy with everything. It's just the tax stuff I'm not so happy with, right? So I'll become a loyal American citizen except for taxes. Right, tax system. They'll tell me, what are you crazy? I'll say, well, what do you mean? There are probably millions of Americans who don't pay taxes. I will be an American who doesn't pay taxes. What's the big deal? Now, if you were the judge, would you accept me? Of course not. Right? It's one thing to be American and not pay taxes. You don't lose your citizenship because of that. But to become a citizen with conditions? I would like to become an American, but not this, not that, can't do it. Shammai, in essence, seems to be right. But Hillel was very confident that he could convince this guy, and he could actually teach him Torah on one foot. So Hillel said to him the following. He said, you know what, no problem, I can teach you Torah on one foot. So he said to him, that which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend. The rest is commentary, go and learn. So he didn't let him off scot-free, right? He said, the rest is commentary, go and learn. But what did he mean when he said, that which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend? How is that an encapsulation of the entire Torah? How is not eating lobster an encapsulation of that which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend? Fasting on Yom Kippur, that which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend. Study Torah, that which is hateful unto you. How is all that a commentary? And it's a very famous statement, I'm sure everyone's heard of that statement. That which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend. But how is it that that encapsulates the whole Torah? How is everything in the Torah a commentary on that? And I think the answer is hinted at in Rashi. Rashi, the great commentary from France, says the following. He says that really, friend has to be understood in a broader sense than just fellow person. He says, God is also described as our friend. There's a verse, there's a beautiful poem we say, Yedid Nefesh Av Harachaman. God is called the beloved of the soul. Ani Ladodi, in Song of Songs, God is called our beloved. So that God is my friend. Who else is my friend? Not Telly Savalas, right? Who loves your baby? Whatever, it doesn't matter, right? For those who remember, right? The literate members here, right? Anyway, but who else is your friend? The answer is, of course, your fellow human being, and God, and who else? There's one other friend. The closest possible friend I have to who I am is my soul and myself, correct? So what Hillel is saying is the following. That which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend. Meaning, if you could live your entire life and you would take into account the needs and the wants and the desires of three groups, of three beings, right? God, other humans, and your own soul, would that be cool? Sure, that'd be the essence of it. You know what the Torah is? Judaism is a commentary on that. How is it that you can live taking into account God, your soul, and other people? That is an encapsulation of it. There are three types of mitzvot, commandments. Mitzvot bein adam l'makom, between a person and God. Mitzvot bein adam l'chavero, those that govern my relationship with other people. And mitzvot bein adam l'atzmo, and commandments that govern my relationship with my own self. And if we'd really go through life, and everything we do, we're always taking into account myself, soul, others, and God, wouldn't we all, it will be a wonderful and perfect world. That is the ultimate goal. And this is number one in the encapsulation of Judaism, is refinement in each of these three areas. And to think that we don't need refinement, I think is very wrong. I mean, no one is there yet. No one's there yet. When you are young, right, we're totally unrefined when we're young. We get older, we get refined a little better. But in every area, we need this refinement to become aware of others. Sometimes, you know, I have been in situations where it's type of like, you're standing in a crowd or in a party or in a room or something like that, and there's a person who just basically keeps like bumping into you or something like that. And they're type of like ignoring your very existence. And I feel like saying, excuse me, I live, I exist, I am here. Because this person does not, is just like, they don't register my existence. You ever feel like that? Just like saying, I exist. I exist. Right? When I drive often, I feel like saying that. You know what I mean? Because there are people who drive like, oh, you're here? Like there's another car on the road? There are other people on my turnpike? The chutzpah. It's like unbelievable, right? Why should I signal someone else? I mean, what, you know, but that's how it is. People don't realize, don't take into account other people's existence. Or there are people who don't take into account their own soul. They satiate the body. They satiate everything else, but yet the soul remains starved. The soul remains starved. And it's very sad. There are people out there who their greatest, for them, the greatest heights of human existence would be to have their car chosen for Pimp My Wheels. You know what I mean? There would be nothing greater in life than to have excess lights plastered all over your car, a jacuzzi in the back of the Hummer, right? A 103-inch HD TV, right? In the LCD screen, state-of-the-art sense-around speakers, subwoofers, right? 3,000 amps that will sterilize elephants from 300 miles away. It's unbelievable. This is what the ultimate, for some people, you would ask them, what would be the ultimate fulfillment in life? They'd say that. Such a person's soul, guaranteed, is starving. Starving. Right? And all they're satiating is the other aspects. And there are people who totally ignore their relationship with God. They go through life as if, yeah, ignoring Him, ignoring His reality, ignoring His existence. So Judaism, number one in Judaism, is refinement in these three areas. To yourself, as they say, to yourself be true. Right? To others and to God. That is number one. The second, I would say, is reflection. Meaning, thought and free will as opposed to just reflex. Reflexes are good. Reflexes are very good when it comes to driving, when it comes to many, many areas of life. Reflex, good to have good reflexes to do things without thinking. You know, so you have to think every time, you know, it's like, which hand do I use for the blinkers and for the windshield wipers? That's actually rough. And I was driving in Australia just now. So we drive on the other side of the road. So I know you're thinking, so how do you get there? Doesn't matter, right? So we drive on the other side of the road. So, which is not a problem for me because the steering wheel is on the other side of the car. So you automatically get into that mode. The only thing that I find, I kept putting on the windshield washers because it was the wrong hand for the blinker. I don't know if anyone has driven in England or anything like that. That is probably what you're going to be doing a lot, putting on windshield washers. So reflex is good there. But when it comes to my relationship with other people, when it comes to how I act in the world, to ethics and to just to everything I'm doing, I don't know if it's so good just to totally act out of reflex, totally act out of instinct. It's good to think, and it's good to contemplate and to exercise the one muscle which is often not exercised at all, which is the muscle of free will. Free will. To exercise that power of free will. And we often don't do that. We often just go through life. A good friend of mine who lectures all over the world, he said, in his unofficial survey, he has found that 2.5% of people think. approximately, he says. He says another 2.5% think that they think but don't really think. And the other 95% will do anything, pay any amount of money, go to any lengths, God forbid, rather than think. Anything rather than think. They will make sure that their mind is filled with everything else so they don't have to think. For instance, they will wake up to a radio alarm clock, to a talk show, Curtis and Kubi or whatever it is, or something like that, first thing in the morning. They will go into the shower. Well, they will have purchased from Sharper Image a waterproof radio CD player, or even worse, television, for the shower. Okay, the family is pounding on the door and you're in the middle of a soap opera, right? And is there, so this is what you do, right? And then you get into the car automatically. The hand goes for the radio and you put on the radio because you've got to hear the traffic. Even if you're stuck in traffic, you want to hear the traffic. It doesn't matter. I don't know why. People have this impulse. Every 10 minutes, I've got to hear the traffic. You could be sitting there at the Lincoln Tunnel. It's 45-minute jam. You know it's 45 minutes. You put on the traffic. What's he going to tell you? What are you going to do differently, right? You're going to hover out of there? You're stuck there. You can't do anything. Why do you put on the traffic? And sometimes the idiots on the traffic say, everything's fine at the Lincoln Tunnel. I'm sitting there like, I look out of the helicopter. Hello! Look down, idiot! So we have continuous input at this point, the traffic and the news. Every 10 minutes, we also have to hear the world news. Why? Why do we have to hear the news? Does it make a difference? Is it going to change in 10 minutes? First of all, anything you hear has already happened. Too late to do anything about it. It's already happened, right? And secondly, on the vast majority of events, there's absolutely nothing I can do about it. So, but nevertheless, we're compelled to listen to it. And then we get to the office in the elevator on the way up. There is a television screen or there's music playing. And then you get to the office on the computer and you've got streaming audio while you're working. Okay, so that we never have. And then we get home, we relax, right? And eat dinner with the family and with the television on. So we're going to continue to see, but can you imagine if for one hour or one day, let's say, there was some type of problem and every piece of electronics in the entire country ceased to function. MP3 players and Blackberries and all the email and computers and televisions and radios and phones. It's nothing. What would happen? Yes, people would go insane. I read a survey recently. They surveyed people who worked in IT companies, information technology companies, and they found that 35% felt the loss of email for 1 week would be equivalent to a serious car accident or divorce. Thus, in terms of the amount it would affect them, how badly they'd feel, they rated it up there with a car accident or a divorce. I don't know what this says about their marriage, but I mean, it's the loss of email. And when you think about it, there's continuous input. Why do we need all the input? I think part of it is people don't want to think. In other words, if we'd be just quiet by ourselves, no input, no music, no radio, nothing, what would we be forced to do?
Read.
Yes, reading is a form of thinking as well. Sitting and watching the television is not. But reading, we'd have to contemplate, we'd have to think. Right, it would be a very, very shocking thing for a lot of people. They begin to contemplate, why am I here? What am I doing on earth? What's the point of my life? Right, why am I struggling like this? What's happening? What are we doing? And be very frightening answers. So one of the purposes of the Torah and the mitzvahs is to give us time to reflect. I was listening to the radio in the car this morning, right? And I was listening to Curtis and Kubi. I'm not sure who's more stupid, but they're both stupid, right? One's right wing, one's left wing, and you begin to think, I don't want to be any wing if this is what it is, right? But they actually, one of them this morning, is an interesting point. He said, you know what? Everyone should have a time every day, like half an hour in the morning before you go to work, where you don't have the phone on, you don't have email, you don't have the radio, and you just be able to think about your life, about why you're working, what you're doing in life. And he says also, it'd be great to have it in the middle of the day as well, like 10, 15 minutes. And also at the end of the day. I'm sitting there so frustrated because the guy who's saying this is Jewish. Kubi. Extreme secular left wing. He's Jewish. Hello! Has he ever heard of prayer 3 times a day? So, Chris, half an hour before we go to work. Think, why am I working? What am I here for? Right? 15 minutes in the middle of the day, afternoon service. End of the day, captain's log. Right? Mariv, evening service. We have this. We have this. Right? People say to me, I saw in a magazine, I think it was called Wired, which is one of these magazines about all these. So a guy was talking about the need for a data Sabbath. He was describing him and his girlfriend sitting on the couch watching television. So he says they're watching television, they've got 150 channels in the cable they can choose from. They're both sitting there with their laptops. Because in between they're working on some assignment, right, either for work or for she for college, he's doing some work with the laptops. He says they have next to them their Blackberries and their phones. He says occasionally they're getting emails and they're getting phone calls and they're doing instant messaging and text messaging and they're watching the television at the same time and they were doing this and they look at each other and they say, whoa, this is crazy. And I'm very impressed they actually realized it was crazy. And they said, we need a Sabbath, a data Sabbath. And I said again, I thought to myself, because the author of this article was Jewish, and I thought to myself, you know what? You've already got one, man. Right? You just don't know about it. So that's the second idea, is to give us times and opportunities and reasons to reflect and to think and to exercise free will. Because you know, Maimonides says in the Guide for the Perplexed, this is a very major philosophical work of Maimonides, he says, you know what, the human being, that when it says the human was created in the image of God, that refers at least to the ability we have to choose, free will. Our ability to make choices, moral choices. Now, the person sitting on the couch with the cable controller, choosing between 150 channels, you don't look at this guy and say, look at the majesty of man. Created in the image of God. The world at his fingertips. No. Maybe if he threw it out the window, that would be free will. I don't know, right? But again, that is the human being's essence, is free will to make choices, not just to go on autopilot. That's art. Second. The first is refinement, the second is reflection. The third is relationship. Relationship with God. Relationship with God requires that we be compatible and similar. Any relationship with anyone that you want to enjoy, that you want to have pleasure in that relationship, requires similarity, compatibility, requires a certain intellectual and spiritual closeness. You cannot have a relationship with someone with whom you have zero in common. I mean, it may be on the most superficial level, but to enjoy being with such a person is just not going to happen. I mean, you can take, some great philosopher, Alvin Plantinga from Notre Dame, for example, and put him in the same room as someone who is on the opposite end of the spectrum. Right, who has never thought, who wouldn't know what philosophy was if it hit them in the head, right, and put them in the same room for a few hours, they wouldn't enjoy it. I saw, there was a competition quite a while back, I've mentioned this before, Coca-Cola, right, you open the cap, look inside, there's a code inside the cap, and if you get it says either try again, or it gives you a winning code. I had a guy at my house, it said try again, so he puts the cap back on, and he takes it off. He says, hey, this is not working. Right, so, actually, I was at the store the other day. I bought a New York lottery ticket, and I went into the 7-Eleven and to check it. And I said, "Do you mind checking the ticket for me?" She says, "Sure." She says, "I'm sorry, it's not a winner." I said, "I lost." She said, "Yeah." I said, "I can't believe it." She said, "I said, can I get my money back? I mean, it didn't work. I mean, I paid $1 for this ticket, and it didn't work." And she actually thought I was serious for a second. You know, just hands hovering over the security button. But anyway, right. So he's trying, try again. The first prize in this competition was 1 week with the Backstreet Boys. The Backstreet Boys is a rock group. Right, which in order to actually enjoy them totally, you require extensive facial piercing, generally through the frontal lobes would be most helpful. But anyway, so you have 1 week, this was the 1 week with the Backstreet Boys. You could be backstage with them, serve them drinks and other pharmaceuticals, no doubt. Right, and you could get to tour with them for a week. This was the first prize, which, you know, for many teenagers would be a wonderful thing. So anyway, at the same time in Newark, the Berlin Philharmonic was playing a series of concerts conducted by Herbert von Karajan, the great German conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic. So I imagined to myself the following scene. Herbert von Karajan has just finished conducting Beethoven. 2 hours of this. He's hot, tired, he finishes the concert, standing ovation, etc. He goes backstage to the Coke machine, feeds him some Deutschmarks, right? And he opens the Coke bottle and he looks at the cap and says, "Aha! I have won." Let me ask you something, folks. Would 1 week with the Backstreet Boys, would that be first prize for Herbert von Karajan of the Berlin Philharmonic, or be a condemnation to the depths of hell? I'll tell you what, the answer is B. Because there's nothing in common, there's no relationship here. Right, they're different, same planet, different worlds. Right, and so therefore, in order for us to have the relationship with the Creator, with God, requires compatibility and similarity. And one of the things that the Torah teaches us, when we study Torah, which is what we're trying to do now, except for my interruptions, right? What we're trying to study Torah, we are trying to get into the pathways of God's mind, in a sense. We're trying to think like God. When we give charity, when we act with justice, etc., we are trying to imitate God. We are trying to inculcate within ourselves a similarity and to become God-like. As the verse says, "V'tachasrehu me'at me'elokim." Humans were made a little less than God. "V'hod v'hadar ta'atrehu," adorned with glory and honor. That is our possibility, that's our capability. We can be all the way up or all the way down, and it's a possibility for the human being to have a relationship with the Creator, with God, with the infinite God, by emulating Him, by imitating Him, by creating that relationship. So that's the third component, is what I would call relationship. Number four is revelation. We've got refinement and reflection and relationship, and now we have revelation. Revelation I picked up in Santa Barbara. I was teaching at University of California in Santa Barbara to a group of students there, extremely laid back. I mean, so laid back, it was almost a near-death experience just sitting with them. It was like unbelievable. Right? And so I was schmoozing with the students, asking what they were majoring in, what they were studying in college, which is often amusing in American universities. What you can actually study is beyond imagination. Brown University in Providence offered a course. I remember seeing this and I was there for a Shabbaton. Empowerment of women with eating disorders through Native American song, dance, and crafts. I mean, I'm sure it's very, very important. If you have a, you know, maybe it can help. I don't know, right? But I mean, I wouldn't pay $30,000 a year for this, certainly not. Anyway, so I asked him. I asked this one guy who's really laid back. So I say, Chuck, what are you majoring in? And he says, I said, no, precisely, please. And he said, oh. And I said, go ahead. And he said, I'm something between religion and philosophy. Something between religion and philosophy. So I said, could you be more precise? He said, sure. I said, go ahead, right? And it was like water out of the stone, I'm telling you. This was unbelievable. To get one coherent sentence out of this university student was unbelievable. I couldn't, right? So, he said, I'm majoring in revelation. Revelation. I thought to myself, I went to a Hasidic high school in Melbourne, Australia. I am a Hasidic, actually. I know, don't look it. I'm Reform Hasidic. Anyway, so... They taught us that the founder of the Hasidic movement, the Baal Shem Tov, used to say that anything you see or hear, anything you experience, is there for you to learn from. If you didn't learn from it, you've wasted the experience. So I thought to myself, okay, imagine if the Baal Shem Tov was sitting here with me in Santa Barbara. A little hot with a strimal, but nevertheless, let's imagine. Right? What would he have learned from this guy? And I thought, you know what's explicit in the Zohar? The Zohar says that every single human is majoring in revelation. Our purpose in this world is revelation. What that means is that we are poised between concealment and revelation. When we do an action, that action can either reveal godliness or it can conceal it. If I do an action of egotistical selfishness, of cruelty, someone could do an action of incredible evil, incredible cruelty, and they're yelling Allahu Akbar, God is great, at the same time. There is no greater concealment of godliness than doing that. No greater concealment of godliness. Someone can quietly, without saying anything or yelling anything, run into a burning building and save people. That person is revealing godliness in the world. even if they don't yell, especially if they don't yell, Allahu Akbar. Right? And so revelation and concealment is dependent upon what I do in this world. If I act in one way, person looks at me and says, man was made in the image of God. If I act in another way, person will say, naked ape, primate. Right? That's what they'll say. And that's where they'll see. So that is really where we are. Right? We are poised between those two. Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto says, every single person on the face of this planet is able to either reveal or conceal the godly within them and within the world. Sometimes you can conceal more than, but sometimes by revealing you can conceal, by concealing you can reveal. What I mean is that it depends. If a person dresses in a particular way, you are so overwhelmed by the body that you cannot see that there's a soul there. Right? I remember seeing, where was it, in this movie, I saw many movies on the plane. I mean, after 15 hours on the plane from Australia, you are forced to watch movies. And it's interesting, I think I watched 3 movies. I remember only bits and pieces of each of them. I was asked, drifting in and out of consciousness, right? Watching the movies, like fall asleep, you wake up, and you're still in the same movie, or maybe it's the next one. You couldn't figure it out. It was unbelievable. So I have this like now one movie in my mind, which has got the most bizarre combination of circumstances, like a murder mystery in Disneyland with which is kung fu as well, and it's unbelievable. But I remember one scene where this woman was going on a date, and she's brilliant, brilliant. Brilliant woman. And her friend says to her, no, don't dress like that. She says, what do you mean? She says, no, you've got to dress in a way that he won't realize you're that brilliant. In other words, you've got to show more of yourself, so that he won't realize you're so smart. This was the advice she gave to her friend. Now, granted, this is a movie, right? But part of what she was doing is concealing the self, which actually does involve the soul and the intellect, by revealing something else. So really, we are poised between revelation and concealment. Very often, when we look at the revealed part of the world, we're concealing the other part. I remember I was a rabbi in Toronto for 4 years, I bought a copy of Grey's Anatomy at the bookstore because it was on sale. It always is on the bargain books, right? There's always bargain books. You ever go to any bookstore anywhere, there's a table of bargain books. Always have the same books there. Great trains of 17th century Europe, Ethiopian cuisine, whatever. I don't know, that type of stuff, right? So Grey's Anatomy is always there, So I figured I'd buy it because it was $4.99 Canadian and it was about 600 pages. And I said, my God, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's like a sin not to buy this book. So I bought it, and I'm reading the stuff about the face, which is very interesting to see all the muscles and the jaw, the structure of the bones and the veins and the arteries and everything. It's like, it's really an amazing thing to see. And I'm reading this, totally focused on it. Anyway, the secretary says, Rabbi, there's someone here to see you. So I put away Grey's Anatomy, I take out my Talmud, and this person walks into the office, right? And I'm sitting there, oh, yeah. Anyway, the guy walks in, sits down, and as he sits down and starts talking, I'm looking at him like this. I am staring at this guy's face like he thinks I am totally focused. He thinks, whoa, the rabbi took some Ritalin with his Prozac this morning. I'm very impressed. This is unbelievable, right? So, like this. And what I'm seeing? I'm seeing he's got a little click in his jaw as he talks. I'm saying, what the heck is that? I wonder what's happening down there, And he's talking. After about 10 minutes of my focusing here, he puts his hand on mine. He says, what do you think I should do? My first reaction was, go to a plastic surgeon. What are you asking me about? You got a click in the jaw. You can't do a rabbi. What are you, stupid? And I realized, the problem was, I was so focused on the external that I totally missed the essence. The essence is what he's speaking about, what he says. That's the essence. The face is the mechanism which is used to express that. But I was so focused on the face that I couldn't even hear the essence. So I was involved in an act of concealment. Concealment. And that's indeed where the human being is, concealment or revelation. And the fourth aspect of the Torah is the concept of revelation. And we believe that there's time and space and ego, and time, space and self are really three areas where it's either possible to conceal God in that or to reveal God in that. If you just allow time, right, to pass you by. We don't seize the moment and look for the spirituality in every single moment and day and month, etc., etc., then it's concealed. Space also, there can be either a revelation of spirituality in that space. It can be a spiritual space, or it can be devoid of that. It's really up to us. I remember in Israel, my first week in Israel, I was just, 2 weeks after I finished high school, I made Aliyah. So I was in Israel, and I was standing in a bank. This was about half an hour before closing, 12 o'clock. Standing in the bank, it took me approximately 25 minutes to do a 5-minute transaction, right? And which is pretty standard there, right? And anyway, I'm about to leave the bank, and the security guard runs over to the door and locks it, because closing time. But I mean, I understand. So I said to him, look, I understand you don't want people to come in. You know, banks are very, you know, strict about that. I said, but you could let me out. I would sell a set, but I'd like to leave. And he says this, which is just the Israeli symbol for shut up and wait a second. It's Hebrew, right? Just doing that. So I said, Slicha, you know, I'm a little about, been here for half an hour, you know, right? You know, something that should take 5 minutes. You know, open the door. And he says, wait. This is unbelievable. I'm getting very upset here, right? Very upset. Anyway, I hear from behind me a bang, right? All the tellers stand up, and they start mincha, afternoon service. I count, and I realize I'm the 10th man in the bank. They waited. They had a captive minion, and they locked the door, so I'd have to leave it. Now, they transformed that space into a very spiritual, beautiful space. It's possible to do that, right? And, you know, time can be transformed in that same way, and so can self. And that's the fourth idea, which is revelation. Number five is realization. When things are just lofty concepts, they're not real to us. Things become real to us when we bring them into the physical world. Judaism is not a religion, just a thought. There's no sense. In other words, imagine, let's say 3,000 years ago, God said, folks, for 1 week a year, I'd like you all to think about freedom and the Exodus and stuff like that. Talk amongst yourselves. Think about it. Do you think anyone would have heard of the Exodus? I don't think so. What did God say to do instead? Eat matzah. Have a meal. Eat matzah. Relate the story to your children. Drink 4 cups of wine. Eat bitter herbs. Have symbols on the plate. Eat a nice meal. Sing certain songs. Don't have any leavened bread in your house. In other words, many actions. Many, many actions. Right? God didn't just say, your home is really a temple. Your home really is a sacred space. It's a beautiful sacred space. Think about that. He didn't say that. You know what he said to do? Write the words of Torah on your house. How do you write the words of Torah on your house? A mezuzah on the door. Right? We don't do graffiti. We write, put a mezuzah on our door. That is a way of saying this house is a sacred space. Very beautiful. And by the way, the mezuzah is, you ever notice, just parenthetically, it's at least Ashkenazim, European Jews, have it at an angle, diagonal. You know why we do that? There are two different views. One says it should be vertical, one says it should be horizontal. So we have it diagonal. Which is actually unusual, because usually in halacha, Jewish law, we choose one or the other. We don't do a compromise, because then it's neither. I think I saw a Hasidic explanation for this once. This is to teach you, as soon as you walk into the door of your house, first thing you see is compromise. Right? First thing you see, you walk into your house, okay, take it easy, chill. If it's not like that, okay, it'll be like that. Right? If it's not like that, okay, it'll be like that. Compromise. It's a very important lesson, you know, very important lesson. Especially for men. Come home from work, you know, said to my wife the other day, you know, Chavi, you know, every man deserves one day a month where he doesn't need to be sensitive and talk about the kids and what went on in the day. He can just have his caveman day, one caveman day a month, where I can come home or I can come downstairs and say, men want egg. That's it. She said, that's a great idea, honey, but you're about 10 times over your quota for this month. You know, like, so compromise. Now, so realization. Realization means taking a lofty and beautiful concept and encapsulating it in a very simple physical thing. Just for example, we believe that the fact that a human being can stop working, can take time off and contemplate and think and sing and converse and talk and pray is showing the light of the soul in this world. And when we want to display that, what do? And the person responsible for transforming a certain time and place into something sacred, which displays the divine light, is the woman. So, but what is a way of saying that in a very graphic way? Friday afternoon, she will take some candles and light Shabbat candles. So what we're doing really is we're taking a concept and putting it into a physical format. It's almost like art or sculpture, isn't it? When you think about it, right, Rodin, great French sculptor, right, what he did is he took, ever seen Thought, the thinker? This guy sitting there like that? I remember one of my kids saw it, not the original, but they saw it, Rodin. I said, what do you see? What do you think of, kids, when you see this? Right, no? Because I was trying to teach them a little bit about art. You know, what do you see when you, what do you think when you sit, when my kid says, ooh, how embarrassing, man, he's naked in front of all these people. I said, no, he's thinking, guys, he's thinking. They said, how could you think when you're sitting naked in front of all these people? I said, no, stop focusing. They cannot get off the subject. All they can talk about, right, for the rest of the day is the fact this guy's sitting naked in front of thousands of people, right, so the whole art lesson, goodbye, right. But you see, what he did do, for those who appreciate it and get actually around that, right, is that he took the concept thought, and what he did is he put it into a physical format that I can easily relate to. Like Salvador Dali did with nausea, for example, right? That type of thing, right? So it is, you're taking something and putting it into... That is, I think, what the commandments are. The mitzvot are like sculptures. Beautiful sculptures, works of art, which take a lofty concept. Think of the Hanukkah candles. We just lit Hanukkah candles. Last week we finished, right? And so what an amazing thing. When you walk by a window and you see Hanukkah candles in that window, you are seeing a miracle of Jewish survival. After all these years, all these empires, all these people have tried to Hellenize us and to assimilate us and etc., etc., the Greeks and the Romans and the Borg and everyone else, right? They look at us, right? And you look at this and you see the candles here. I see there are one or two Trekkies, but okay. Right, you see the candles there, you're seeing a miracle. All encapsulated in this little oil and little flame. It's an amazing and beautiful thing. That's the fifth aspect of the Torah, which is realization. And the final, number six, is responsibility. Responsibility. Judaism ultimately believes that no one, you cannot be good merely, or you can have a good society just because you've got good law enforcement. That's not going to be enough. All the law enforcement in the world is not going to help unless people individually have a feeling of responsibility, an ought, a feeling that I ought, I'm obligated, I ought to do something. The idea, if you borrowed money from someone, so in secular law, that other person has the right to collect it from you. But the fact that you feel responsibility to pay it back, it's a religious concept. That has its source in the idea that I ought, I'm obligated. Obligated? Where does that come from? In the secular concept, completely secular law, the idea of obligation is almost non-existent. It's mainly rights. I have certain rights, you have certain rights. It could be that in order that you have to do certain things because, right, because my rights have been infringed upon, etc. But it's focused on rights. Judaism, through the commandments, is focused on a sense of responsibility. A sense that I ought, that I'm obligated to do something. That's really the essence of it. Susan Last Stone, a professor, she's a visiting professor at Harvard at the moment, wrote in the Harvard Law Review, she said, the notion of obligation in the Jewish legal system is not a mere linguistic reversal of the term right. Rather, the Jewish legal system consists of commandments that specify precisely who is obligated to do what and for whom. The commandments are focused on obligation. You look at it, you see, when a Jew celebrates her bat mitzvah, she turns 12 and is obligated in commandments. That's a celebration, the time of joy. Let's think of the secular equivalent. What's the secular equivalent of bat mitzvah or bar mitzvah? Well, or something like that, or you turn 18. What can you do when you turn 18? You can get a driver's license, you can buy alcohol, you can buy cigarettes, you can join the army, you can get a gun, right? It's that you can kill yourself and other people in numerous ways. It's beautiful. It is just touching. Right? And what was really being celebrated there is, I have all these rights now. I can get this, I can get that, I can get this, I can get that, you can do this for me, etc., etc., etc. However, in a bat mitzvah or a bar mitzvah, what are we celebrating? Not rights. So obligations. And I think that's a beautiful thing. When a child is educated with a sense of obligation, they're a different person than someone educated with a sense of rights. When the class is continuously talking about, well, you've got this right and this right and this right, who's the focus when you're thinking of rights? Moi. Moi. Right? Swimming in Lake Me, in the words of a recent movie. I'm swimming in Lake Me. When I think of obligations, I realize that everyone's in the same lake, right? And I'm trying to help everyone else swim. And that's the idea of the commandments. So we have refinement, reflection, relationship, revelation, realization, and responsibility. And each of these has a little... I think they represent to a great degree what Judaism is about. Now, but I want to tell you, I want to end with what Hillel said. When the non-Jew came to Hillel and said, teach me the Torah on one foot, Hillel did do that. But what did Hillel add at the end? The rest is commentary, go learn. I will say the same thing to you. The rest is commentary, go learn. Right? At this point, this is the obligation, at the very least, is that to study, to understand, and to grow. It's always better to know than not to know. And learning is an amazing thing in Judaism. We have this central commandment to learn, not just for professionals, not just for clergy, but for everyone. And that's a very, very beautiful concept. Many opportunities to do so, both through Torah Links with Rabbi Serebrowski, both through the program you've got on the chairs there with whatever the 10,000 Jews learning, 10,000 books or whatever it is, right? I forgot, but it's the exact numbers are there, right? Whether it is with Gateways, upcoming seminar, we have President's Day weekend, 3,200 years of Jewish learning in 3 days, same amount of food in that time, and... again, in the Marriott in Somerset, which is not too far away, it's still in New Jersey. You don't have to cross international borders or anything like that. Right? And lots of opportunities. And thank you all for coming. And that's it.